Griping about his girly drink.
Well, I love orange creamsicles.
I gave you that one.
And I do not like orange. I thought it was mango at first. Oh, my God.
No, I love those things. I hate that you can see my hands.
I don't know what to do with my hands.
I hate that I look like a crazy lady.
That's okay. I'm wearing yesterday's makeup.
And I cried all the way over here.
She's not joking.
It's not nice that you laugh at her pain, Audrey.
I was laughing at my own pain earlier in the closet.
We all know that our family does not know how to deal with emotion very well, so.
True.
Yeah, like whenever I get angry, I clean.
Same.
Just so I can slam cabinets and stuff.
See this spoon? Bam!
Yeah. This refrigerator needs to be cleaned out.
Well, Tori and I look like rats. We've already determined this. It's been a lazy day. It's been a crazy day. Tori had work.
Yeah.
Little minty bee. But we're good now.
It happens.
Josh had to work today.
Hey, I was the only one off. I'm all for it. They gave us some overtime. I'm taking advantage.
Yeah.
When I clock out tonight, I'll be at like 64 hours.
Heck yeah. Will tomorrow's go on it?
Yes, it will.
Sweet.
So it'll be like a 70-something hour check.
Heck yeah.
Well, 1 week. Yeah. And I have next week to still go on it.
Where you been, girl? What you been up to?
You know, just been working every day.
Two jobs.
Yeah. You know, just been living life, going through it. What about you, Audrey?
Oh, I just had the week off.
Oh,
it's been great. I've been cleaning. I took a nap the other day. Huh? Running kids everywhere. Normal stuff.
Yep.
It's been great. We better cover our news first. Jumping the gun over here.
Well, I mean, you're not really, because there's not really any news.
Yeah, we don't really have any updates. Same old.
There's really nothing there. I mean, I look for something to give you guys every single time, but I think I got the cream of the crop the very first time.
You peaked way too early.
That's so, all right.
I'm going to have to start looking at like other sources and stuff way in advance.
Well, or even like a cool fact or something.
Well,
cool.
I have one of those.
What's up?
You like Fruit Loops, right?
Yes.
What's your favorite color?
They all taste the same.
Okay. They've scientifically proven that they all taste the same now.
Okay.
All right.
Mm-hmm.
Is that your only crazy fact?
That's the only fact.
Yeah, you peaked way too early.
I literally just happened to see that just now. Well, so I was like, oh, well, there's something at least.
Yeah. Was I supposed to say favorite color? Did I mess it all up?
Yeah, I was really hoping that you just... Man. Were that person that
purple.
Thought
purple.
They all tasted different.
Do you want to try again and I'll just pretend?
No, it's okay. It's all right. Because I don't want to make you look stupid either.
Well, you know, I recently learned a crazy fact that I guess everybody knew but me.
What?
But maybe some of our viewers didn't know. The Europeans ate mummies. Like, they ate the mummies.
Where the f- Where are you getting your news from?
Look it up. Look it up.
Eating mummies?
Because they believed it was medicine. Medicinal.
Well, yeah, medicinal. I could see that.
They would go in and they would steal these mummies.
That's weird.
And their gold and their jewelry along with it. Oh, and they well, would yeah, break gold, down the bodies, obviously. Put it in these capsules, and just swallow it.
Hmm. That's not much.
But
I mean, it is different, but not much different than moms doing that with their placentas.
I guess, but also they had this weird thing where it's like, you can only choose a certain mummy. Like,
so you had to name it?
Someone that died of natural causes was the best mummy to eat, apparently, because like they died of natural causes. Like, they didn't have any diseases or anything. So they would try to find those mummies in the tombs.
Was that like people jerky?
Basically. Okay. Like cannibalism in the early ages.
Wow. I mean, I've got drawings here that are talking about it.
That's wild.
That'd be a cool episode.
Wouldn't it?
Dark history.
Mm-hmm. Yeah,
sounds like we've gotten a new episode to cover, guys.
Go, Tori.
We should go to the pyramids. Let's go to the pyramids.
Oh, I would love that.
That would be so fun.
Maybe whenever we get, you know, like...
stable. Financially.
A million. A million.
Emotionally.
A million followers. Maybe we could do that.
Well, in order for that to happen... they have to go like, comment, subscribe, share.
Talk about.
Tell your friend.
Oh, yeah. Spread the word.
Tell your neighbor.
Spread the word, man. Word on the street. The Guilty and the Ghostly podcast is the best.
There we go. So make sure to do that.
Hopefully you heard that.
Yeah. Otherwise, we're going to look like weirdos.
I meant to say the Guilty and the Ghostly podcast is the best, but, you know, couldn't. Have to be humble.
It may have picked you up.
Blurred it out.
It might have.
We'll find out.
I did turn your microphone up for that reason.
Yeah.
It's probably heard me swallowing times... this whole time. And...
oh, it's very possible.
There's a lot of new crime updates about like the Murdaugh.
Yeah, we covered that last week.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. I figured.
Crazy. Yeah. Crazy.
Yeah. That's pretty interesting. Are there any updates on that at all?
Mm-mm.
No, it was the judge that they're saying persuaded the jurors. And from what I understand, it's pretty bad. Pretty bad. Like, she gave one of the jurors a ride home. She gave got one of the jurors' sons a job. Like, she's doing things on the side.
Wow.
And so I started looking at that case a little bit more. We'll cover this when we cover it again. But I got to thinking, there were two different guns used. Why? If there's one shooter, why were there two guns used?
Mm-hmm. I remember that. I think it even kind of pointed to that in the show we watched.
Did it?
I think so. I think towards the end, during the trial part, they mentioned something about something like that.
I'm not saying that he wasn't involved, because I think he was involved, but I wonder if somebody else was there.
You know, there's a lot of people saying he wasn't involved and that, like, his 911 call was so distraught that, like, he probably knew the people that were involved and just didn't want to say anything. Probably money troubles or something.
Yeah.
That's my guess.
Unless it was somebody that he was involved with trying to tie up some loose ends.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Allegedly. All for entertainment purposes.
Yeah, allegedly. Going back to new updates in the true crime area, there's updates about the David murder.
Yes.
And how he bought two chainsaws.
And kiddie pools. And body bags off of Amazon.
That sounds like a great party, guys.
Well.
Okay, well.
You remember how you sent me to the store to get those three things? Imagine buying those three things and walking up to the counter.
How do you not get flagged for that?
That's a good question.
I feel like they should.
Like, if you buy these things, then.
Like, are those like USDA rated? I guess they rate those body bags.
Like, are morgues just going on to Amazon?
They go to Amazon and type in bulk body bags.
That's insane.
That's weird.
That is kind of wild. Do you think that'd be like some kind of medical distributor that made that. Yeah. There had to be some kind of specific rules.
Like, they would have to order it within their orders that they do.
Or, like, old dude went on there and ordered, like, Halloween fucking props and some or something.
I still think
didn't realize it.
Yeah.
I don't know.
It's just crazy.
He comes in and they're just, like, a hefty bag.
Yeah, I don't know. Well, that's what he did, is ordered them on Amazon.
That's crazy.
And then they're saying that he kept her body for, like, 2 weeks before he dismembered her.
And there's, like, videos of him.
Where did he keep the body at? In a fridge?
In his kitchen.
Just sitting
on the, I'm pretty sure, because...
Sitting on the kitchen table?
Or his bathroom or something, because in a live video, he was talking about it stinks in here, and the girls were like... Why?
Yeah, why does it smell like that?
Yeah.
Wow, I need to look into this guy.
No, we should. Will, it's a yeah. big case, but it's still in...
Like it's in trial. It's happening right now. It hasn't even gone to court yet. So he hasn't been sentenced.
Mm-hmm.
And it was, like, involving a 13?
Yeah, she was, like, 13. He was 26?
No, I think he was younger than that.
But it started when she was, like... 11, I think.
She was young. They met on, like, a Discord server. Through, like, maybe Roblox, maybe. I don't know.
Yeah. It's wild. We'll definitely cover it, but I kind of want to see what happens.
Before we cover.
When they go to, yeah, after they go to court, because I'm sure more evidence will come.
But there, it's probably going to be a while, because yeah. he is a famous singer, and, like, in his songs, you can tell he's singing about killing her. And in all of his music videos, all, like, the female actors that he uses looks like Celeste.
And he says her name in a song. It's crazy. It's a crazy story. Well, that's all the true crime we need. You guys ready to talk about a murder?
Yes.
Possibly.
You can leave. I'm just kidding. No, you can't. Don't move.
I had to give you a dramatic don't pause.
Please. Okay. Please don't leave. Don't leave me. So I have no idea how we're going to open this episode, because we started this episode yesterday with Tori coming over and hanging out. We had a few of the drinks and got a little loosey-goosey.
We had a good time.
Had a good time. But we took a lot of side quests, so I'll see what I can cut and add. A lot of it's probably going to be taken out. And after we went through that 30-minute spill and side quest, we got into the story, and we all got relaxed, and everybody started falling asleep. So we said, TBD. So you may hear Tori in the intro. She's not here tonight. She's celebrating. So it's just me and Josh.
Yep.
So you've heard a little bit of the first, but not the end.
Yeah, but honestly, by the time you started talking about that, I was so tired, I don't really remember anything.
Well, good. It'll be like a new story.
I barely remember the conversation last night. I was out of it.
We were very loosey-goosey, very relaxed.
Yeah, and I've been working all week, so yeah. I'm really tired.
Working OT, so... I'll see how I splice it together. You might get a little bit of last night's conversation. You might not. It depends on how bad it is. So we'll see what I cut in. You ready to dive in?
Almost.
On June 4th, 1960, in Finland, four teenage friends went camping near Lake Bodom. This group consisted of 15-year-old Malia Irmeli Jorklund, 15-year-old Anya Tuliki Mackey, and she goes by Tuliki.
Did you ask her?
Yes. No.
She told you that?
R.I.P. She's not here.
Oh. Then how do you know?
I'm guessing.
Oh.
Good luck to us. We'll see how this turns out.
Canceled.
Maybe. We also have 18-year-old Seppo Antero Boisman and 18-year-old Niels Gustafsson. Tuliki and Seppo were a couple, and they had been dating for a couple months, so not super long. And then you have Malia and Niels, and they had only been dating for about a month at this point. Tuliki was the youngest of the group, and she had just turned 15 3 months before this trip. Originally, her parents did not want her. Really, neither one of the girls' parents wanted them to go on this trip. They were young. They're going camping. I think their parents knew they were going with boys, but I'm not 100% on that. The boys were older. Their parents didn't really care. But I did see in one source where the boys' parents really didn't know that the girls were going with them. They thought it was just the boys going. And the boys knew each other. I've seen a couple of different sources. One said that they met where they worked at. They worked as apprentices at a foundry. But I've seen another source said that they'd actually been friends for a long time since they were like 12 and grew up together. And they just so happened to work at the same place as well.
Yeah.
But the girls' parents eventually said, okay, yeah, it's fine. You can go on the trip. So this camping trip was kind of a celebration. It was summer. They were kind of kicking it off. Niels and Seppo would actually be joining the army in just a few months due to Finland's mandatory military service. At the time, Finland actually required most young men to complete a conscription service. And this camping outing was just kind of a celebration before that. Each couple would ride on mopeds and carried with them one single tent that Seppo borrowed from work. They had half a liter bottle of liquor, a bottle of citrus liquor, and a few beers with them. They also packed some food, fishing equipment, and a few tools that they thought they might need while they were camping. They arrived at about 5 p.m. on the south side of the lake. They chose a spot that was at the tip of a peninsula close by like a swimming area, but it was also closed off enough to where it still gave them privacy. So they're close to the swimming area, but they're kind of, the view's kind of blocked and they have their own privacy.
Mm-hmm.
Once they got there, they decided to go to a kiosk down the road before setting up camp. And so they went to this kiosk, they bought gum, they bought some sodas to mix with the liquor that they had brought, and they ended up getting back to camp at about 7:15 p.m. There were still a few swimmers in the area, but they were kind of starting to dwindle down. There wasn't very many, and everybody was kind of leaving for the night. Seppo started putting up the tent with the opening facing east away from the swimming area. According to Malia's diary, the group spent the evening making fishing poles out of some birch sticks that they found, and the group would end up going fishing and swimming that evening. The boys would end up having a few drinks. They asked the girls if they wanted any. The girls didn't drink. It was just the boys. While fishing, one of the boys actually found a rock on the shore and brought it back to the campsite to help hammer the stakes down a little bit farther in the tent to make sure it was really secure. They secured the guidelines of the tent, and then that tent was very small. Like, it was a very small tent. Like, they couldn't even stand up in the tent.
Mm-hmm.
There really wasn't enough room for all four of them, but they're like, it's just, you know, one or two nights. We'll make it work.
We've been there before.
Been there, done that. Well, later that night, Seppo ended up waking up in the middle of the night and was like, I think I'm going to go fishing. And Niels was like, I'll come with you and I may get in and swim for a little bit. So they went down there. Seppo ended up doing some fishing and
the other guy spent his time scared the fish away.
Niels got in. The water was a little too cold, so he ended up getting out of the water. So they fished for a little bit, and they would end up going back to the tent and return back to the girls and all going back to sleep. Well, while the teens were sleeping, someone would come to their tent site, violently attack the teens. It appeared they were attacked with a knife and a blunt object. The teens would be brutally stabbed, slashed, and beaten to death.
That's like everybody's worst nightmare when they go camping.
This is literally what scary movies are made of.
Yeah, like, that's every scary movie that has a campsite in it ends like that.
Yeah. You see the teens swimming and having fun. There's the couples and
yeah.
Somebody sneaks in and
you know what happens?
Yeah, I literally have it written down.
Sex. That's what happens.
That's very true.
Every time that happens in the scary movies, somebody dies.
Yep, 100%. I wonder if Niels was skinny dipping and that set it off.
Maybe so.
Well, the light-colored tent would end up collapsing. It was covered in blood. Their skulls were fractured from blunt force trauma, and the knife wounds basically covered their arms and chest area. On June 5th, 1960, a carpenter named Esko Johansson stumbled across the scene, and he alerted the police around 11 a.m. I did see some other reports that said that it was actually a jogger named Risto Siren that found the scene at about 11 and reported it. But regardless, people were starting to walk up on the tent and see something was amiss and called the police. Police would arrive on the scene at 12 p.m., where they would discover a tangled tent with four bodies in a tangled up mess in this tent. Seppo and Tuliki's bodies were found inside the collapsed tent. Tuliki's face was covered by a scarf. Malia's body was laying on top of the tent, and they found Neil's body near Tuliki. They then discovered that Niels was only unconscious, but still alive.
Wow.
So three of them are dead, but Niels is still alive, but unconscious. They would rush Niels to the hospital. He had a broken jaw, a skull fracture on the left side of his head, a concussion, stab wounds and abrasions on his left hand, and he also had a gash in his cheek that was bad enough that his teeth were visible.
Holy shit.
Yeah. So, bad.
Wow, that's violent.
Yes.
That is a very violent attack.
Wait until you hear the other injuries.
That reminds me of something I heard earlier today. I was listening to something. Now you have me hooked on some true crime stuff every now and then.
Mm-hmm.
And I was watching this deal that had a compilation of several different things. And this guy lured this lady out and brutally attacked her, stabbed her 114 times.
What?
64 of those attacks were defense wounds.
Oh my gosh.
She was alive that long.
You hear stories like that, and I'm just like, how did they make it? There's one case that I really want to tell you. I will be covering it. It is very brutal, very brutal. And this girl was abducted by two men. And they stabbed her and slashed her so bad, so bad. They literally decapitated her head. Cut her stomach where her organs were literally falling out.
Mm-hmm.
And she survived.
What?
Literally they cut her, trigger warning, cut her neck so bad that she had to hold her head up so it wouldn't fall back.
I think I've heard of this.
Cut her stomach open to where she had to hold her organs. She literally walked miles until she came across another car to get help. And she survived.
I think I've read this somewhere here recently.
It's a crazy story. I'll definitely be covering it. It's very brutal. It is so bad. But to me, obviously you love survival stories because they survive. But to me, it's... how do these people go through that and still survive? And what's the difference? Just if the knife would have been so far this way, or you hear that all the time, and it's just but they survived. How? How did they survive this?
I don't know. That's crazy.
Yeah.
That's one of those things. That's biggest fear type stuff. Someone cutting your throat or the other part with your guts hanging out.
Yeah.
And she had both.
She had both and literally had to hold her head up so it wouldn't fall off. But she survived. Insane. Well, once Niels made it to the hospital, they began to further examine his injuries. And not only did he suffer from everything that I just listed, but he also had a deep cut to his forehead and was believed to have suffered from brain injury from the fracture in his temporal bone. His left eye was completely swollen shut, and when the police discovered he was alive, he was unable to speak at that time. It actually took a few days before he could talk. And even when he was able to, it hurt so bad because, like, his jaw was fractured. He had so many fractures on his head. It just, like, it would literally hurt to mm-hmm. try to talk.
It probably hurt just sitting there.
Well, the police would start questioning him, and he would mention seeing an image of a man dressed in black and glowing red eyes walking up to the tent before the man would start cutting through the tent and attacking everyone. But that's all he could remember. Like, he could basically remember up to the point that they went fishing and then went and fell asleep. And then he was getting these little glimpses of the attack, but could not remember anything.
Imagine that being your last memory of what happened to you.
I couldn't imagine.
Like, that's terrifying.
Yeah.
Some guy dressed in black with red eyes. That's...
Killed that's your best friend.
It's the fucking devil.
Yeah. And we'll talk more about that, too. I think it's his brain trying to protect itself. Like
a trauma response kind of thing. Yeah,
because, you know, you got to think. He could have been dressed in all the black, but, like, the red eyes... Yeah. That guy was probably covered in blood. It probably looked like he had red eyes.
That's a very good possibility, yeah. Especially if, like, I guess the blood was running through his eyes and whatever. Wow.
Well, police at the scene began looking at the remaining victims. Both Seppo and Anya were lying inside of the tent. They both suffered from stab wounds all over their bodies and were bludgeoned. Neil's girlfriend, Malia, was laying on top of the tent. Her attack seemed to be much more severe. She also suffered from stab wounds and had been beaten. She was naked from the waist down, and she had dozens of stab wounds, many of which were inflicted after she had already died. The forensic specialist would describe the injuries as being hacked at post-mortem, is basically how he described it.
Wow.
None of the other victims had been attacked after their death. And this led investigators to believe that Malia was the target. Like, she had the most brutal attack.
Yeah, I mean, I was going to say, that sounds really personal. And I think when you told me that yesterday, I said that before mm-hmm. you mentioned it, that it sounded like a very personal attack.
Mm-hmm. And she was the only one with clothes removed.
Yeah. Yeah, and was that, like, because there was a sexual thing involved, or was that just to degrade her?
Yeah. Are you asking me right now?
Yeah.
We'll get there.
Okay.
Well, when police arrived at the scene, they didn't put up any crime scene tape at first. So they didn't section off the scene. So this meant that random campers, searchers, dogs, everybody's just trampling all over this crime scene.
I remember talking about this last night, too, now. Things are starting to come back to me.
This also made it nearly impossible to see if there were any footprints that led to or from the campsite.
Yeah, allowing that to happen is probably one of the worst things you can do in a crime scene.
Mm-hmm. And, I mean, this is 1960s. They know mm-hmm. better.
Yeah.
But they didn't do it.
Yeah, I mean, they had detectives we talked about last night in Scotland Yard.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that knew better then.
Yeah.
That's just, it's just lazy police work, like we said.
Yep. Well, during the search, it was discovered that some of the campers' personal belongings were missing. All of their wallets, all of their IDs, Neil's shoes was missing, Malia's clothes was, like some of the extra clothes she brought was missing, Seppo's leather jacket and the keys to the mopeds were all missing. But the mopeds were still there. They were not. So they didn't take the mopeds. So how are you feeling so far? What are your thoughts?
To me, like, I mean, we talked about the mopeds last night, and I feel like that's not even part of what happened so much as just somebody doing that to kind of keep anyone from following them.
Oh, that's a good point. Yeah.
You know, like, if you were just trying to disable somebody's way of getting away, maybe. So you would disable whatever vehicles they have.
But if they think they killed all four of them, then it doesn't matter.
Maybe. You don't know. In a crime of passion like that, you never know what was going through their mind.
Yeah. Just maybe an extra step just to be sure.
And that might have been a prior thought too. They might have thought, you know, I'm going to do this so they can't get away if they see me coming.
Yeah. Very good point.
So I have a better chance of chasing them down.
Yeah. Did they leave the keys in the moped since they're right there? And then the guy walked up and was seeing them. So he's like, I'm going to grab these real quick so nobody can get away. And
maybe
then
so. I mean, that's a very good possibility. I mean, when you dive into the mind of a killer, it's just.
There's no making sense.
No, there's not. So you all you can do is really speculate in that situation.
Right.
But that to me is what I feel like is probably what's going through his mind. But to me, it seems like a very personal, very passionate crime.
Okay. Well, a search of the area began, and this was literally days later. This was after searchers came to help with the crime scene. So days later, they were able to find Neil's shoes about 500 meters, which is about just over 1,600 feet or 5 football fields away from the campsite, just off the road that led to the campsite. So it was like down the road that led to the campsite. They would also find Seppo's shoes thrown to the side nearby where they found Neil's, but like across the road. And Neil's were actually hidden under a rock. Like they were actually hidden, whereas Seppo's, it looked like they were just discarded, like just thrown out there. None of the other items that were missing were ever found. They also could not find the weapon used in the stabbing, believed to be a knife, or the item used to cause the blunt force trauma. At the time, they did believe it was probably a big rock that was used. I did see in one source that they supposedly also found a pillowcase that was rolled up and secured with an elastic band. It had traces of blood and semen on it. Supposedly, testing was done, but they could not confirm who the fluids belonged to.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I only seen that in one source. To me, I don't know necessarily if that's right, because to me, if they had that, they would have tested it later when technology was better to be able to compare it. And
right, you would think that, and there's also the possibility that that may have been some of the evidence that was lost.
And we're in Finland too.
True.
So I don't know what their
very
protocol
true.
Is.
Very true. That is a very good possibility. And who knows how long they keep evidence there.
Yeah, because this was in the 60s, so.
Mm-hmm.
Well, eventually a time frame would be based off of a group of boys that had been out bird watching that morning just across the lake. So according to them, around 6 a.m., they looked across the lake. They seen a tent collapsed and a man with long blonde hair leaving the campsite. And they just thought it was like a camper leaving his tent. Like, they didn't really think anything of it.
Mm-hmm.
From other eyewitness accounts, they believe that this man was in his 20s and about 5'8". So some other witnesses seen a man in the area that went by that description. Once the bodies of the other victims were removed, authorities were able to reconstruct the crime scene. They were able to determine that the murderer slashed through the tent ties and then attacked the victims through the tent. So the attacker would literally cut the lines, causing the tent to fall on the teens, and it would just attack them through the tent,
That's
never
crazy.
Actually entering it.
That is super crazy. That is
so creepy.
Scary.
Like, again, that's just like what scary movies are made of. You're mm-hmm. sleeping and then all of a sudden your tent falls and you're kind of disoriented. Like, what in the world's going on? And then you just start getting brutally attacked and
mm-hmm.
you can't really find your way out because the tent is collapsed on you.
Mm-hmm.
And that creates a perfect outline of their bodies so the attacker can see exactly where they are.
Yep. Man.
Autopsies would be done on the three other teens. Seppo had suffered from multiple stab wounds to his neck. His hands rested on his chest, looking like he had been asleep at the time of the attack. The cause of death was blood inhalation, so he basically choked to death on his own blood.
Mm-hmm.
Tuliki was found curled up and laying face down, partially covered by a blanket. Her top had ridden up, exposing her midriff, but her jeans were still buttoned and on. They had not been removed. She had also had severe blunt force trauma to her head, causing multiple fractures. Malia had defensive wounds on her arms and was stabbed a total of about 15 times, most of which occurred post-mortem. She had extensive facial and skull injuries. Her pants were down to her knees on the left side, and the right pant leg was actually pulled completely off. Her blouse and jacket had been pulled all the way up to her shoulders, exposing her chest. One of the hits to her head caused her forehead to completely shatter, along with other fractures to the side of her head and jaw. This would have caused severe brain swelling and basically immediate death. The amount of force that would have had to take to do that.
That's crazy. I mean, that's what I'm saying. Like, this must have been somebody that had something against these, or at least her.
These kids? I mean, yeah.
And then other people just happened to be there at the time. Or maybe they had something to do with it. I guess I'm going to find out.
We'll get there.
Okay. This better not be one of your open-ended things again, because that killed me almost.
Well, we'll get there. Well, police would interview nearly 4,000 people.
Oh, my God.
They were able to compile a list of about 88 suspects before narrowing it down to just a few. So,
how many people are in the area?
I don't know. And I'm sure this is tips coming in and people calling in. And we'll get to that in a minute on how that it led to that. So before we get into the suspects, let's talk a little bit more about how the crime scene was investigated, because it was not great. I already told you they did not section it off.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And that already kind of made me feel like there was going to be some more stuff that went wrong.
Well, not just mentioning that, but there was basically no control over if somebody decided to take or move anything from the crime scene. Oh. Because people are coming in and out of there, and people did that back then. Even I think we talked about it last night about that one murder, which I didn't look it up today, but it's a fruitcake murder. That's all I can remember, is there was a fruitcake in the kitchen when this family was murdered way back in the day. And before police got there, and I think even after the police got there, neighbors were freely walking through the house and, like, picking stuff up and taking it with them as, like, souvenirs, I guess. I really don't know.
That's weird.
So, there's that. Fingerprints and DNA were not properly preserved, so maybe that explains why that was never really tested. There were questions on how evidence was even processed. Items were handled and removed from the site before they were properly documented. They did eventually find Neil's shoes, but again, that did not happen till later in the investigation. So what other items did they miss? I mean, they didn't find the shoes till much later, and all these other things are missing. Did they just skip over it? Very few sketches and photos were taken of the crime scene, and the exact position of the bodies and items was not documented. So, making the reconstruction of the scene pretty inaccurate. They just had vague details.
Wow.
Blood tracing and other evidence testing were not used, even though there were some options available in the 1960s. They just didn't do it. It was later found out that the boys that provided the description of the man were not even interviewed any farther other than just getting their generic statement.
I wonder why that happened. Like, was it because they could only get so much information out of them?
I don't know.
So they just kind of gave up?
Or again, is it just laziness? Like, oh, yep, got your description. Okay, see you later.
That kind of seems to be the MO of this particular group of people. So, I mean, not all cops do stuff like some of them really work and find what they're looking for. But then again, you have the ones that just...
And it seems like the ones that mess up, they don't just mess up like one little thing. It's like a snowball effect where they mess up everything.
Well, and I'm sure probably it starts out just a little bit and then they just get a little lazier and just push the limit just a little further.
Yeah.
Until the big thing happens.
Ends up like this. Well, despite all of these issues, they did drag the lake to see if any evidence could be found. They did not locate anything. They found some stuff, but it had nothing to do with the crime scene. They were able to locate the diary of Malia, but one of the bottles of the liquor was also missing. So they had two bottles of liquor, and one of them was missing. The one that was still there was found with a partial fingerprint that did not match any of the victims. So now let's discuss suspects. A bloody knife would be found in a nearby village, and a soldier would be arrested. After testing the blood on the knife, they discovered it did not match any of the victims, and he was released. But my question is, whose blood was it? Why was there a random knife with blood on it found? And then just be like, oh, it wasn't them. See you later. Mm-hmm. Like, I've got questions. That doesn't sit right with me.
Yeah, no kidding.
Then we have Paula Lily Luama.
Did your record just skip?
No, that's his name. I literally looked up the phonetic spelling. It's P-O-L-L-O-Y. Paula Lee.
Interesting.
Well, Luamu matched Luama. I think it's Luama is his last name. He matched the description of the attacker that the boys had given. He had also approached someone in the forest near the location of the murders. The day after the murders, he was seen with bloodstains on his chest. He had been arrested for a robbery prior to this, but since he did not have a history of violence, they just sent him to a labor facility, but that the day of the murders, he would escape that facility. And there was actually a manhunt going on for
him. Oh, my God. Why? It seems like every single time we have these crazy serial killer type people, they just get out of jail somehow.
They just leave.
Just like, oh, I don't feel like being here, guys.
I'm out.
Can you let me out?
I'm just going to walk. I'll be back. I'll see you later.
I'm going to go get some lunch. You guys want anything?
Yeah.
I'll be right back.
It's wild. Well, a manhunt would be pursued before finally finding him. He was brought in, but was so drunk that they had to hold him overnight until he could be questioned. When they finally did question him, he had a credible alibi for the time of the murders. He was seen by about a dozen other people at a hut at the time of the murders in a nearby village. The bloodstain on his shirt was supposedly the result of an injury he got while escaping the facility that day. So that's suspect number two.
That's crazy.
Then we have Pentti Soininen. He was not even on the authorities' radar until in the 1960s. Years after the murders, he would confess to another prisoner while serving time. They found out that he was living in a care home near the murders at the time of the crimes. He was known to be unpredictable and violent. He had a history of mental illness and psychosis diagnosis later in life. However, if he was the one that committed the crime, that meant he would have only been 14 years old at the time.
Mm-hmm.
Authorities did not believe that he would be capable of disposing all of the evidence without being caught at such a young age. Not to mention, he did not fit the description of the man they saw leaving the campsite that day. But, oddly enough, on the 9th anniversary of the murders, he would take his own life.
That's weird.
Very weird.
That's really weird. Did he leave a note or anything?
Nope.
Nobody knows why?
Nope.
Not even a clue?
Not a clue.
Wow.
So each suspect, it's just getting a little bit weirder and a little bit weirder.
Yeah.
It's going to continue. It gets weirder.
Hmm.
Then we have 51-year-old Carl Geistrom. He ran the kiosk.
All these weird names and you have Carl.
Coral. I know. Don't ask me. Well,
this guy sounds fake.
He's here we go.
I feel like you're making this part of the story up now.
I've really just made up this whole thing. I'm just kidding. I wish. It sounds like it. It literally sounds like it was made up. Well, 51-year-old Carl Geistrom ran the kiosk at the lake. So the kiosk that they went to get their gum and sodas, that was his kiosk. His house was also just a short distance up the road from the campsite. But Carl had dark, slick back hair. He was known to be very spiteful and had a reputation of hating local campers, especially the younger ones. Locals said that he would hide razor blades in his fruit, like the fruit, the apples on his trees, to deter people from picking the fruit.
Sounds like a real good neighbor.
He was also known to be a drinker. He had conflicts with his neighbors as well. A neighbor once caught Carl illegally hunting. So, Carl raised his gun and fired at the neighbor. Luckily, the neighbor wasn't seriously hurt, but he did have to have buckshot removed from the shooting.
Wow.
There was another time that a truck driver was driving down the road leading to Carl's house. Suddenly, the driver hears a loud, like, noise and his window shattered, sending glass shivers into his face.
Shivers?
Slivers.
Glass. Are you cold slivers. Or something?
Yeah. Glass slivers into his face. It was discovered that Carl shot at the driver. When he was questioned, he said he had only done it to discourage drivers from coming down his road too fast. Logical. I think very logical thinking.
Mm-hmm.
Carl was also known to put planks with nails on the road to deter people from going down his road. He was known to keep an iron pipe in his car and a curved hunting knife in his belt. He was also known to cut the guide wires of campers and the campers' tents.
Interesting.
The kiosk that the campers went to get their gum and soda was the kiosk that Carl worked, which I already told you that. That day, Carl's wife was the one working. After the campers left, his wife closed the kiosk down at about 9 p.m. She went home. She was just kind of telling Carl about her day and just happened to mention the four teens that stopped in to buy supplies. When the campers went back to their campsite, they also had to go right by Carl's house to get there. In fact, when one of the witnesses went to call the police after discovering the crime scene, it was that kiosk they went to call for help. And according to that witness, when he told Carl what he found, Carl seemed very unbothered. Not long after the murders, Carl was seen filling in a well on his property, raising even more suspicion. Niels and Seppo's shoes were found on the road that led to Carl's house. Authorities would question Carl. His wife would say that her and the kids slept in the bedroom that night, and Carl was in the main living room area sleeping. She said that the room door was open throughout the night, and Carl never left the house. The police would do a search on Carl's home, but locals felt like the police did not search it very well. They didn't even check the filled-in well. So what are your thoughts on him?
That dude sounds suspicious as hell.
That's suspicious.
No, seriously. And why wouldn't they dig the well back up? Like, if they already have evidence pointing toward this guy, what's it gonna hurt?
Yeah. Just to check. Just make sure.
The fucking murder weapon's probably at the bottom of that well.
Very well could be.
It gets worse and worse for the police in this town.
It does. It does. Well, Niels would be re-interviewed by authorities. So he ended up being in the hospital. I may mention it on down. He ended up being in the hospital for like 4 days before they were able to release him because of the brain injuries. At first, he still had no real memory of what happened. He did say that he was attacked first. He did remember that. And he still remembered seeing the guy with the like glowing red eyes, but he really couldn't remember any other details. And so eventually, police decided to call in a hypnotist to see if they could access a part of his brain that was blocking out the events, which was pretty common back then. Now they have realized, almost like the polygraph test, it's not very liable. Like, it's not a for sure way, but back then it was completely normal.
Yeah.
Let's see here. During the sessions, I think he ended up having three different sessions. But during the session, Niels would describe a stern-looking man, long, slicked back blonde hair with large protruding eyes. He had deep forehead wrinkles, thick lips, and a large nose. This description seems to match the vague description that the boys had given. They used Neil's description to make a sketch of the attacker. So I'm going to show you the sketch, which I'll insert it on the video, but for now. So close your eyes for just a minute so I don't show you these other pictures. Close your eyes.
I might fall asleep if I close my eyes.
Okay, that's the sketch that came up with. Kind of creepy.
Not a very good looking gentleman, is he?
No, he's kind of creepy. A little bit creepy. Well, this sketch would resemble another man on the list of suspects. I'm going to say this name. We can laugh about it. And then we're going to move on. We will not laugh about it anymore. His name is Hans Assman. So that we don't giggle like 12-year-old little boys, I'm going to call him Hans. But his name is Hans Assman.
What's his name?
Hans Assman. Well, Hans was allegedly a KGB spy and former member of the Nazi Party.
Oh, geez.
Who had been a person of interest due to some off behavior around the time of the crime.
I think he introduced himself like James Bond.
My name is Ass Man.
Hans Assman.
Oh my gosh. Poor unfortunate soul. Well, he allegedly was held prisoner for about 2 years before escaping and then switching sides and joining the KGB, according to him. On June 6th, 1960, so this is just that day of the murders, maybe it was the next day, at 10:45 p.m., an unconscious Hans arrived at the Helsinki Surgical Hospital about 13 miles from the murder site in an ambulance. He was wearing dirty overalls, covered in red stains. His hands were also covered in red stains and caked with dirt. His wife was with him and said that Hans had collapsed after complaining of severe stomach pains. At one point, Hans was being checked out by the doctor, and when the doctor poked him, Hans giggled. He'd been faking being unconscious to be seen faster.
What?
Yeah. So he was faking being unconscious and wanted to go to the hospital to be seen faster. So I guess he really had been having severe stomach issues. And I guess he wanted to be seen faster. So he pretended to be unconscious and be taken by ambulance to be seen faster.
That's crazy.
Well, when his ploy did not work, Hans became very irate and began getting aggressive with the hospital staff. The staff began keeping a close eye on him due to his odd behavior. While he was there, a random woman that was not his wife came in and started talking to Hans in very shushed whispers for a while. He was also seen vigorously washing his hands. Hans would end up being in the hospital for like a few days before being released, but that wasn't the last time that hospital staff would be seeing him.
Anytime you go to a hospital, it's a good idea to vigorously wash your hands. I'm just saying.
Probably. Well, during one of his other visits, he would show a doctor an article in a magazine of an unsolved murder. And he really was interested in this murder. Another time that Hans came in, he was joking with the surgeon that he was also very skilled with a knife, but unlike the surgeon's patients, those on the other end of Hans's knife would not survive. At this point, the hospital staff decided to report his odd behavior to police. They're like, something's not right. This man is not well.
Did he also harm animals?
I don't know. Wouldn't surprise me. We're fixing to talk more about him.
Wow.
There was even a medical intern that was so concerned with the way he was acting that when he came in that first night, he bagged up his overalls and kept them just in case. Authorities really didn't seem too concerned about it, though. About this time is when the sketch was released that was based off of Neil's hypnosis session, and it's very uncanny how similar the picture looks like Hans. So I'm going to show you a picture of Hans. So that's the sketch. That's Hans.
Oh, yeah. That 100% looks like the same dude.
Very creepy. About the same time the sketch was released, they're seeing this Hans guy in the hospital being real sketchy. Something just did not seem right. So once that sketch was released, about 50 tips would come in, but no, it didn't really drum up any leads. They would track Hans down, but after he provided them with what they considered a solid alibi, they would let him go.
Mm-hmm.
According to Hans, he had been at an apartment with a lady he had been sleeping with, and as for the blood on his clothes, according to Hans, he spilled something on his shirt when he was drunk and doing some, like, home decorating.
He spilled blood on his shirt home decorating?
Well, it was supposedly later tested and was paint. Supposedly. Oh.
Like, can't you tell the difference between paint and blood?
That's kind of what I'm thinking is this is a hospital staff. Like, they know what blood looks like.
You would think so.
Very weird.
Jeez.
Much later, it was discovered that Hans reportedly bribed the landlord and hostess of the apartment to be his alibi.
I mean, are we that much more educated now that we just know the difference between things like
that? That's why this story blew my mind. It was just like, what?
I mean, I don't know, because, like, I mean, I guess back then they probably really weren't that educated.
I don't know.
I don't know either.
Well, shortly after being interviewed by police, Hans would then go and shave his long blonde hair to a buzz. It was noted that he was known to be abusive and was a suspect in a previous murder. So as soon as he starts getting questioned by police, he starts changing his appearance.
Mm-hmm.
That's fishy. So let's talk about this previous murder. In 1950, a young woman named Kaliki Sari was riding her bike home from a devotional service later one night. This was about 3.5 hours northwest of Lake Bodum. She vanished that night, and 2 months later, her bike would be found in a bog near the area where she had disappeared. 3 months after that, her body would be found in the same bog. Hans became a suspect in the murder when his wife called to report that Hans had been in the area the night that Sari went missing. They were never able to link him to the murder. And in 1997, Hans was on his deathbed, and he called a journalist. He would tell the journalist that he would not talk about the details of the Bodum murders. Like, the way he said it was almost like, yeah, I know about it, but I ain't talking about that. So very fishy.
This whole entire story's been strange.
Yeah.
The way that it was handled, the way that people talk about it. Continue. I'm genuinely invested in this.
One of the doctors that was working the day of that Hans came in would say that they truly believed he was part of the being a KGB spy. And they believe that's why he wasn't too concerned with being charged with the murder, because he had immunity. Authorities, of course, denied these claims. Although authorities moved on from him as a suspect, the public still believed he was the main suspect in the case. Hans would later admit to on his deathbed to killing Kaliki Sari, he claimed he hit her with his car before disposing of her body, trying to cover up the crime. At this point, many years have gone by, and the public is wanting answers, and the police really couldn't provide any. Then, 40 years later, a shocking twist of events would occur. After the murders, rumors started circulating, and one name would be brought up. Niels Gustafsson, the only survivor of the attack. At the time, this was just rumor and speculation around town from desperate people looking for answers. Police did not really take them seriously at first. He had no motive. He had been brutally attacked as well. But that did not stop people from questioning why his injuries were, quote unquote, less severe than others. Despite the rumors, Niels would recover and be released from the hospital just a few days after his attack. He lived a pretty normal life until 2004, when Finnish police reopened the case, citing new evidence. So this is 40 years later. He's already built a life, has probably moved on the best that he can from this, and now they're going back for him.
Mm-hmm.
Blood samples and DNA were taken from Neil's shoes. It was discovered that his shoes had blood from all the victims on them. Police claimed they had proof that the murderer had worn Neil's shoes during and after the attack because there was no blood in the soles of his shoes. So the blood hat was all over the outside, but there was none on the inside. So they said that proves the murderer was wearing these shoes.
Mm-hmm.
Niels would be brought in for questioning, but his story stayed the same. Now, if you remember, Niels had substantial injuries himself. However, social media caught wind of this new development, and it became a huge story. Some people thought that maybe this case would finally be solved. Others were not convinced that Niels would kill his friends and girlfriend, but would he even be able to cause that kind of damage to himself? Not to mention where his shoes were found. So they claimed that he discarded his shoes, but that means he would have had to walk that entire length back in just socks or barefoot all the way back to the campsite. But when he was found, the bottoms of his feet were clean. They were not scraped up. Like, they were perfectly fine, and his socks were not. They did not look like they would have if he would have walked that entire length back to the campsite.
Wow.
The ones that didn't believe that Niels did it felt like the police were just using this just to be able to close the case and say that they solved it and basically cover up their own mess-ups. They were basing all of this on blood splatter evidence on his shoes. Police were saying that Niels was the murderer and his injuries could be easily explained. They said that the broken jaw was from a fight between him and his best friend. So basically, they said that Niels made an advance towards his girlfriend and she turned him down and he became irate and Seppo had to step in and he waited till everybody went to sleep and then attacked him through the tent is basically what they were saying happened. After the fight between Seppo and Niels, Niels would then go on to attack Anya and his girlfriend Malia. He would then remove Malia's clothes to make it appear to be a sexual assault. He then stabbed himself to make it look like he was the victim as well. The police would say that the key piece of evidence was the traces of DNA from all of the victims on his shoes. They would suggest that the man seen leaving the area by the boys was Niels himself. So what's the motive? According to authorities, a witness at the campsite had spoken with Seppo and Niels that night. Niels was supposedly hammered when he was supposedly seen trying to fight his friend. Allegedly, two other witnesses would come forward and say that Niels had confessed to them over the years, saying that he did it. One of the witnesses was a lead investigator, and he would go on to say that the admission was incredibly vague. So one of them was an investigator saying that he said that. Another female witness said she overheard Niels bragging that he had not been connected to the murder of his friends. But at this point, Neil had basically built a life for himself after the tragedy. He had gotten married. He had two kids. Then in August of 2005, Niels would officially be charged for the murder of his friends and girlfriend.
Wow.
In court, Niels seemed to be calm and level-headed, more almost annoyed with having to defend himself so many years later. There were many witness statements heard, some from people that were only 11 years old at the time of the murders. And of course, this is 40 years later.
Mm-hmm.
There was a woman that claimed to be staying at the lake that night, but she never went to police to make a report. This woman said that Niels was drunk and trying to fight his friend. But when she was cross-examined, she could not give any other details. She couldn't tell you what color of hair they had. She couldn't tell you what color of clothes they had. Like, her statement was basically bogus. She had nothing. Yeah. And when they're like, well, why didn't you come forward? And she's just like, I don't know. I just didn't. And then all of a sudden, 40 years later, here you are.
Wow.
Neil's defense attorney, Rita Lepiniemi.
What?
They would argue that the evidence showed that Niels was inside the tent when the attacks happened. His blood would be found inside and outside of the tent. It was also found in between the slashes and the tears along with the other victims in the tent. So she's like, so he's being attacked just like they are. And it's the knife's coming out and transferring the blood through these slashes.
Mm-hmm.
They also brought up Malia's diary that did not collaborate with what the witness was saying. It never mentioned them meeting or talking to anyone else that day. So in her diary, it matched up with what Niels was saying, and it never said anything about them meeting up with anybody else or talking to anybody else like this witness said she did.
Evidence isn't pointing too well for Niels, is it?
Well, that kind of helps. I mean, because her diary doesn't say that they seen anybody else, but this supposed witness that has no recollection of any details is saying she was there. But Malia's diary never said that there was anybody else there.
Hmm. Okay.
The prosecution kept using Neil's lack of memory as a smoking gun, saying that he could clearly remember that day leading up to the attack, but just somehow couldn't remember that they did not visit any other tents. He could remember up to certain points, and so he's like, yeah, we did this, we did this, we did that. And they're like, but all of a sudden your memory shuts off, you can't remember anything else. And he's like, yeah, I have a brain injury. I was bashed over the head. That's how that goes.
Mm-hmm.
Neil's attorney argued the fact that there was no motive for the killings and items from the scene were never found. They argued that the police's supposed motive did not hold up either, saying that Niels was jealous of Seppo because he was there with his own girlfriend. So they're like, that doesn't make any sense. Why would he be jealous of Seppo and his girlfriend? Or why would this happen when he had his own girlfriend there? Like, they're just like, these things aren't adding up. They're just not making sense.
Yeah, that doesn't really make a whole lot of sense.
Despite all of that, the prosecution stood by their claims that Niels made sexual advances on his girlfriend Malia. She rejected him and he became irate, was kicked out of the tent. When he tried to enter the tent again, him and Seppo got into it, causing some of the injuries. Then Niels would return later that night, killed Seppo, Anya, and then took his rage out on Malia because she rejected him. So that's what they're saying.
Wow.
He would then hide all of the items to make it look like a robbery gone wrong. Finally, to make his story more believable, he would cut his face, hide his shoes, and then lay next to Malia to be found. Mind you, according to them, he's doing all of this while completely drunk.
Holy crap.
Yeah. Medical witnesses would be brought to testify that Niels had exaggerated his injuries. So the slice to his cheek, they're like, it wasn't that bad. The head trauma, he didn't have head trauma, but it was even shown that he had cerebral fluid leaking out of his nose and his actual facial bones were broken. And they're like, it wasn't that bad. So remember, his blood was also found inside of the tent. So when he was attacked while he was in the tent, not after the tent had already collapsed in the struggle. So his blood is found inside the tent. So if he's doing all this to himself, why would his blood be found in the slashes and in the tent?
Mm-hmm.
The trial would last 6 weeks, and October 7th, 2005, Niels Gustafsson would officially be acquitted of the crimes. So, not found guilty. He's good.
That's crazy. Why would he admit to doing it if he didn't do it?
He didn't. He never admitted to doing it.
Oh, maybe I misunderstood you. Who admitted to it?
That's just what the prosecution was saying, that he did this. He did all of this. That's what the prosecution was saying.
Okay.
And then they had that weird random witness that came out of nowhere saying, oh, yeah, I saw him and seen him fight with his best friend, but she had no other details of it.
Okay.
So this is straight them saying this is what he did. And he's like, no. There was even at one point where after they arrested him, he was in his cell and he was just frustrated. And he said something to the effect, I don't have the quote in front of me, but like, wow, 40 years later, and now I'm going to spend the rest of my life in jail. And they're like, see, he admitted it. He did it. And he's like, no, I was frustrated because I've been trying to put this behind me. And then you guys are charging me with this. What am I supposed to do?
Mm-hmm.
They're like, nope, you admitted it. Wild. Well, he would end up being awarded 44,900 euros, which is about $53,000.
Are you fucking kidding me?
In the U.S.
How long did he spend in jail?
Well, he was on trial for 6 weeks, so I guess during the trial, I don't know exactly how long he spent in jail.
I thought you said he spent years in jail.
No, so the murders happened.
Uh-huh.
40 years later, they charged him.
Oh, right.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. Okay, so I guess it really wasn't, I guess that just kind of paid for his lawyer fees and whatever else kind of.
So they said, the Finnish government said it was for mental suffering and wrongful imprisonment during the investigation and trial.
That just doesn't seem like enough to me.
Yeah. There have been no updates in the Lake Bodum murders since then.
Wonder why.
People wanted answers. Carl was still on the top of a mini list due to his history. even though he didn't resemble the sketch that was released. One individual that truly believed Carl was the perpetrator was Ulf Juhusen. Ulf would have been 18 years old at the time of the murders, and he actually even had his own run-in with Carl when he was younger. He was riding his bike down the road, and Carl would begin throwing rocks at him when he was a child. Ulf would actually become a politician, and in 2016, published a book called The Legend of Bodum. In it, he talks about everything that pointed to Carl, one being cutting the lines to campers' tents. In the late 1960s, Carl's wife would be diagnosed with breast cancer. While she was in the hospital, his wife would confess to her friend that her husband Carl was the Lake Bodum murderer. She would go on to say that she made up the alibi that Carl had been home asleep that night because she was scared for her and her children's lives. She thought Carl would attack her. The friend would tell the police of the confession. They would try to interview his wife again, but she would refuse, saying she was still in fear of her and her children's lives. No physical evidence would ever be found linking Carl to the case, so they would close their file on him, and in 2005, an 80-page report on Carl would be released, but it had no new evidence or anything new in it that anybody would point to him.
Mm-hmm.
Many suspicions also stayed on Hans. Hans would die at the age of 74. However, a picture would later be released from the funeral of the three victims. In that picture, there's one person that stands out from the rest. So I'm going to show you the picture from the funeral. Look at that. Why would that looks an awful lot like that guy? Why would he be at the funeral of these teens?
That's a good question. He does look an awful lot like that sketch.
Police did check partial fingerprints that were found on that bottle at the crime scene, but they did not match Hans's. To this day, they still do not know who committed the crimes.
Wow.
It is still unsolved.
Damn you and your unsolved mysteries. You always leave me on a cliffhanger.
At least this one we had suspects. The last one we didn't even have a suspect.
Yeah, I suppose that's true.
But this one, I think, has two really solid suspects.
I think so, too. This was a kind of a cool story.
I think I lean towards Carl.
Think so?
Mm-hmm. I think this crazy guy is just freaking crazy. I lean towards Carl.
What if they were in cahoots?
They could have been, I guess. Two crazies?
Mm-hmm.
There's just too much with Carl. Just like him known to cut the guide wires, lines, whatever, of the tents on campers. And then that's what happened to these kids. Mm-hmm. His house is right there. The only thing that doesn't match up is he had dark hair.
And unless, the magazine had blonde. Unless the other guy did that just to throw somebody off the scent.
Maybe.
Because if he was known to do that and he was known to live in that area.
And if that guy was a KGB spy, he would know.
Right. That's what I'm saying.
He would know.
There's always the possibility that someone's going to try and cover their tracks by pointing it towards someone else.
Good point. I don't know. It's really weird. And just real crap job on the police side.
It really was. But then again, you got to think about the limited resources they might have.
Yeah.
I mean, they may have two or three rural police officers in that area.
Yeah.
That are very untrained. They may not really know anything.
Yeah. And I know a lot of countries like that, the crime rate isn't like it is here. So they may not be used to processing a crime scene like that.
And like I said, they may not have the resource for it.
Yeah.
And some of that crime scene stuff, they may have to send hundreds of miles to have processed.
Yeah.
And who knows how many hands it's gone through that many times and been contaminated over and over again.
And for them to try to pin it on this poor guy, Niels, after all of that, mm-hmm. just because they're saying this is our theory because there was no blood in the sole of his shoes.
Mm-hmm.
That's wild.
Yeah. Well, I mean, at that point, it sounds like they're just kind of grasping at straws to close the case.
Yeah.
I mean, if it's the only little bit of evidence they have, I mean, that's what they're going to cling to and
yep.
see what they can throw at the wall and see what sticks, you know?
And then be like, your entries weren't that bad, brother.
Yeah.
They were bad.
Right.
Wild.
Yeah, this was a weird one. I'm glad you did this one. I like it.
Yeah, I figured you would. I think you like the unsolved ones. You say you don't, but I think you do.
Well, I just don't like leaving on a cliffhanger. But at the same time, it is kind of nice to have that, you know, what if at the very end.
Yeah, the discussions.
Because I kind of like having that, like you said, the discussion. Because it kind of lets us both come up with different theories.
Yeah.
It's kind of fun.
Yeah.
That story I was talking about, there's not a theory that. It's very sad.
Yeah. Is that recently?
Fairly recent.
We'll have to go check it out.
Yeah. I'll have to remember if I can find I'll look and see if I can find it.
Okay. Well, that's all we have for tonight. I've got to go get this edited and posted. It may not hit my midnight like it normally does, but we've been on a holiday schedule, so.
Yep. Well, thanks for watching, guys.
Yeah. Don't forget to like, comment, subscribe, share. It just helps us get the algorithm going in our direction.
Yeah. Help me buy a boat.
No, y'all. Do not.
Start a GoFundMe for a boat.
Oh, Lord. Anyways, don't forget, we are going to FrankenCon at the end of June. June 26th, 27th, 28th, I believe.
That's right.
Planning on being there the 27th.
Yep. We're going to have our setup there, and we're going to be doing some live shows and maybe a few interviews here and there.
Yeah.
It'll have be a good
giveaway.
Time.
We'll have a little giveaway.
I think there's going to be a couple of giveaways. I think they were talking about Bryson was going to bring that.
I don't know if they want that out there yet.
Oh. Okay, well, there may be a big gift or a big...
Don't be spoiling things.
...thing
there. Don't be spoiling.
Oh, I don't know if that's something that we need to keep secret. I don't know either,
but he hasn't said it on Remember That, so I don't want to take away his spoiler.
Okay. I can respect that. I'll respect that.
Yeah. So go follow Remember That, where we are there every week talking about horror movies. I think we're going to go watch Hellraiser while I edit.
Yeah.
Start studying for our next episode with them.
Yeah, next episode, Final Girls.
Yeah.
So we're going to go and watch a few movies we haven't seen in years and kind of brush up on our list of Final Girls.
Yeah. If you guys have any suggestions for Final Girls, let us know. Who's your favorite Final Girl?
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's it. I don't think we have any other updates. I think we're going to record the following weeks tomorrow because we've got plans next weekend. So got to get ahead.
Yep.
So that is it. So tune in next week where the guilty confess
and the ghostly never rest.
Bye, guys.
Bye.